Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Moss, and in the early hours of Tuesday, 11th of April, these are our main stories. The US President Joe Biden has given his strongest indication yet he will run for a second term in 2024. A mass shooting in Louisville, Kentucky has left five people dead, including the gunman, and injured several others. Rescue efforts continue to save more than 1,000 migrants stranded on two boats in the Mediterranean Sea. Also in this podcast,
the feeling that she called me during the attack and I wasn't able to speak to her will come back and haunt me for a while.
A British Israeli mother dies after a West Bank shooting in which two of her daughters were also killed. Donald Trump has a fondness for pinning nicknames on his opponents. And when it came to Joe Biden, he went with Sleepy Joe, a clear attempt to focus on his rival's age and supposed frailty. Fair or not, the fact is that Joe Biden does hold the record for being the oldest person ever to become US president, 78 when he took his seat in the Oval Office. Now he's given this clear sign that he's going to be going for a second term. Mr. Biden was speaking at an annual White House event known as the Easter Egg Roll and told a television presenter from NBC he'd be at the White House to do this event for many years to come.
I plan on at least three or four more Easter egg rolls.
At least three or four more?
Maybe five.
Maybe five.
maybe
so,
six.
So help a brother out. Make some news for me.
I plan on running now, but we're not prepared to announce it yet.
Our State Department correspondent is Barbara Plett-Usher. I asked her how important President Biden's age was in all of this.
It's something that is very much under consideration in terms of people who would be for or against him running. And by that, I mean his supporters, Democratic constituencies, members of the Democratic Party, concerned that he is an advanced age. He's 80 years old now. So he would be, I think, the oldest president if he were to get a second term. But you've heard less of that sort of concern, especially since the midterm elections where the Democrats did better than expected. And also, I think, with the possibility that Donald Trump might become the Republican nominee, the feeling that Mr. Biden would be best placed in order to compete with him. So those are the kinds of things that would mitigate against concern about his age. But it is a factor.
I mean, quite apart from his age, he has had pretty low ratings historically for presidents. Now, I know that they've gone up lately, but even his colleagues, even his friends, don't see him as exactly charismatic. I mean, many people will see this as an odd choice.
Well, you're right about the sort of what they would call soft approval ratings. One of the more recent polls said just a third of Americans thought Biden deserved to be reelected and that a majority in his own party would like to see someone else as the nominee. But there hasn't been a major challenger who has emerged. And it's very much, I think, about electability. Now, of course, the issue is whether Mr. Trump decides or is elected to run or not. If he is, then maybe somebody who is not charismatic and who comes across as a regular guy and who has actually some things to show for his term. He has passed quite a lot of legislation. He is very much focused on getting it practically implemented. Might be somebody who could win. If it is not Mr. Trump, then those calculations would change. But at the moment, in the current political environment, the kinds of opposition that were quietly being voiced about Mr. Biden within the party seem to have become even more quiet.
I mean, all the polls I've seen show that most Democrats do not want him to run. I mean, just briefly, Barbara, is there any way in which in America, you know, senior party members can take the president aside and say, look, this actually isn't a very good idea and dissuade them?
That could certainly happen in private, but that's not the indications we're getting. We're getting a sort of a stronger sense that he plans to run and that he will not be advised in that way in any serious manner.
Barbara Plett-Usher. It's one of those horrible news stories which is horribly familiar. The headline flashes up, shooting in the US. and we watch as the death toll climbs. The site of the latest killing spree is the city of Louisville in Kentucky, a state which has some of the most lax gun laws in the US. Anyone over 21 can buy and carry a gun. No license needed, no checks on your background. And Kentucky already had one of the highest death rates in America from shooting. Around 900 people in the state are killed by guns every year. The man apparently responsible for the latest mass shooting used a semi-automatic rifle to kill four people. At least eight others were injured. His name was released by the chief of the Louisville Police Department, Jacqueline Gwynn Villarreal.
The suspect has been identified as Connor Sturgeon, white male, 23 years of age, who was employed at Old National Bank. His weapon of choice was a rifle. We have five total deceased, which includes him, but I want to acknowledge with heartfelt condolences, prayers to the family of those who lost their life today.
Earlier, I spoke to Tessa Duval, a local journalist in Louisville, on how today's events unfurled.
So about 8:30 local time this morning, police got a call about an active shooter at the Old National Bank in downtown Louisville. It's right next to the minor league baseball field. And what we know as of this time is that five people have died, and that includes the suspected shooter. And there are eight more who were injured, and that includes two Louisville Metro police officers.
Many people struggle to understand how any country could just let these things keep happening again and again. And I suppose I wondered what it's like there on the ground. Do people just shrug their shoulders and say, well, shootings like this are just part of American life? Or are people shocked? Are people angry and upset?
A lot of people are angry and upset anytime that this happens in a community. I've been a journalist for just under a decade, and this is the second mass shooting that I've covered where multiple people have died. The first was in Jacksonville, Florida, several years ago. People also really love guns. Kentucky has what's called permitless carry, so people can carry concealed weapons without having a license to do so. And Kentucky's also an open carry state. So there are very gun-friendly laws in Kentucky in America. And so this is a very divisive issue, and Kentucky has, by and large, very conservative leadership. I will say Governor Andy Beshear, who is a Democrat, shared at the scene today that he lost a close personal friend in this shooting. But if that makes a difference in what kind of legislation we may see in the future, it's just too soon to say.
Tessa Duval, and there's been reaction to today's news from the White House. President Biden tweeted, "Once again, our nation mourns after a senseless act of gun violence. Jill and I pray for the lives lost and impacted by today's shooting. Too many Americans," the president says, "are paying for the price of inaction with their lives. When will Republicans in Congress act to protect our communities?" Now, a British Israeli woman has died of her injuries 3 days after being shot in the occupied West Bank. Her two daughters were also killed. Lucy D. never regained consciousness after the attack, which happened when a gunman fired at her car. She was travelling from the settlement where she lived to go on holiday. Israeli troops are still searching for the attacker and have mounted raids across the West Bank. In one of those raids, a 15-year-old Palestinian was shot dead. From Jerusalem, Lucy Williamson reports.
Lucy D. was helicoptered from the scene of the attack on Friday in a critical condition. She never regained consciousness. In a statement today, the hospital treating her said teams had fought for her life over the past few days, but had been forced to declare her dead due to fatal injuries. Tonight, her widower, Leo D., described the moment he realised the family had been attacked.
"I called Lucy. No answer. I called Maya. No answer. I called Rena. No answer. Then I saw a missed call from Maya at 10:52. I hadn't noticed it ring. I hadn't picked up the phone. The feeling that she called me during the attack and I wasn't able to speak to her will come back and haunt me for a while."
Yesterday, thousands gathered in the settlement of Kfar Etzion for the funeral of his two daughters, pronounced dead at the scene of the attack. Maya, who was 20, and Rena, who was 15. The crowd spilling out from the prayer hall to pack the slopes of the cemetery and the roads around it. Over their bodies, wrapped in cloth in the prayer hall, Leo D. described them as two flames which have not gone out. "How will I explain to Lucy what's happened to our daughters?" he said. One day on, he's preparing to bury Lucy too.
Lucy Williamson. Now to the Mediterranean.
The boat is leaking. Water is entering the boat. The boat is out of fuel. They have no drinking water anymore. There's one pregnant woman in boat and 10 babies. Over.
That's the voice of a pilot reporting on a boat that's in distress off the Italian coast with 400 migrants on board. The Italian Coast Guard says it's rescuing people from the boat and from another with 800 people on board also in distress. I spoke to our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, who told me what he's learned about the conditions.
Both of these vessels are fishing boats and they're both seriously overcrowded, Paul. The one there that you mentioned with 800 people aboard, we don't know a lot about that vessel. We know more about the one with 400 aboard. That the first alert was raised on Saturday night by one charity and it was adrift for a while on Sunday and then a merchant vessel actually provided it with fuel, food and water. So it started to move again, but the charities were very worried for the migrants' safety, so they notified a number of search and rescue organisations, and the Italians were, have been the ones to get there. They're both in Italy's search and rescue zone.
Do we know where these people come from that are on the boat?
Well, Alarm Phone, the charity that first raised the alert, said that it was speaking to boats with 400 people on in with an Arabic translator. And we know that that came from Tobruk, which is a port in eastern Libya. But we don't know much about the second boat. In general, in Italy, what you're seeing is lots of people coming from sub-Saharan Africa, particularly West Africa. The countries that have sent the most migrants are the Ivory Coast and Guinea. But then you get people from as far afield as Bangladesh, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Eritrea, so a whole slew of other countries as well.
We've heard a lot of countries in Europe talking about doing things to deter refugees from coming. I mean, looking at this, it doesn't feel like that's happening with any great success, is it?
No, indeed. The right-wing coalition government has made it one of its priorities.
That's the government in Italy.
In Italy, yep. to tackle irregular migration. But actually, this year, so far, 28,000 people have made the crossing into Italy. That's four times the number for a comparative period from last year. So it's clearly not having a lot of effect. And with we're talking just about the rescues that are going on at the moment of 1,200 people. Since Good Friday, 2,000 other people have been rescued and brought to Italy. So that's 10% of all the year's arrivals just in one weekend.
Danny Eberhard.
You think I know every human being with a mustache wearing an identical outfit with a hat with the letter of his first name on it? Because I don't.
Coming up, another video game becomes a big screen movie, Super Mario Bros.
The attacker had very good knowledge of banking systems.
$2.1 billion in stolen funds.
It's a cyber criminal group.
It was the Lazarus Group again.
These are smart guys.
The Lazarus Heist is back for a brand new season.
We're following the latest twists and turns in the incredible story of the Lazarus Group hackers.
The Lazarus Heist, Season 2, from the BBC World Service.
Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast. I'm Paul Moss. A judge in Italy is set to decide whether a key suspect in the so-called Qatargate corruption scandal should be extradited. Andrea Cozzolino is an Italian member of the European Parliament and he's wanted in Belgium, accused of taking bribes from Qatar and from Morocco. He denies the charges. Three other current and former MEPs are already in custody in Belgium, awaiting trial for their alleged involvement in the corruption scheme. Two of them deny the charges. One has confessed. As for Mr. Cozzolino, he's fighting extradition, as the BBC's Sara Manetta reports.
The European Parliament has been engulfed in a corruption scandal with allegations.
When the news broke last December, it surprised people across Europe. Members of the European Parliament, the only directly elected EU institution, were being accused of taking bribes from Qatar and Morocco in exchange for a more favourable stance in committees and public debates.
Thank you, President.
Both countries have denied the claims.
Qatar is a front runner in labour rights, abolishing kafala and reducing minimum wage.
The woman speaking here is Eva Kaili, at the time the Vice President of the European Parliament. She was arrested after her father was caught red-handed with a suitcase filled with thousands of euros worth of cash. She denies the charges. When the storm hit, EU leaders sprinted into action. They lifted the immunity for two parliamentarians so they could be arrested. And the president of the European Parliament, Roberta Metsola, called for reform.
There will be no sweeping under the carpet. We will ask for more transparency on meetings with foreign actors and those linked to them.
Three current and former MEPs are under arrest in Belgium awaiting trial. One of them has confessed and has been let out of prison with an electronic tag. The other two remain in jail. They deny any wrongdoing. But the fourth one, Italian Andrea Cozzolino, is still under house arrest in the port city of Naples, in southern Italy. In a surprising move, his lawyers are fighting back against the Belgian prosecutor's arrest warrant that aims to bring him to prison in Brussels. We've come to meet one of Cozzolino's lawyers, Federico Conte.
The warrant is completely vague, partial, and sometimes it even lacks transparency. If the Belgian prosecutor has the proof of Cozzolino's guilt, why don't they show it? The fact they don't leads us to think that Cozzolino's arrest is aimed to get him in jail and see if he cracks. If he confesses to a crime, even though he didn't do it.
He also raises concerns over the state of Belgian prisons.
In our opinion, in Belgium, there isn't a prison that could guarantee the health rights of Andrea Cozzolino, who suffers from heart problems. He needs intensive treatment and could risk his own life if he doesn't receive the appropriate care in a crisis.
The Belgian prosecutor's office has declined to comment on these claims.
My name is Alberto Alemano. I'm a professor of European Union law at HEC Paris.
He thinks this case is very unusual. Traditionally, European arrest warrants do not get challenged in court.
Seems to be yet another attempt at delaying, gaining time, and perhaps leveraging on the health status of Mr. Cozzolino in order to somehow tarnish a very difficult and very salient investigation across Europe. So I would say this is not very fair. We see a bit of a David and Goliath situation in which the Belgian authorities seem to fight a lot of pushback from the political system, from the institutional system, and from the very same third countries which are at the very origin of this case.
All eyes are now on the appeals court here in Naples. If the judge were to rule in favour of Cozzolino's claims, it would spark an unprecedented diplomatic incident. But whatever is decided on Tuesday, the Qatargate corruption scandal has already damaged the European Union. The European Parliament used to be one of its most trusted institutions. Now, people across the continent are starting to lose faith.
Sara Manetta reporting. Now, do you recognise this?
There's one problem. There's a human. Has a mustache. Just like you.
Do you think I know every human being with a mustache wearing an identical outfit with a hat with the letter of his first name on it? Because I don't.
That's an excerpt from the new Super Mario Bros. Movie. It's broken box office records for the most successful global opening of all time for an animated film, taking nearly $400 million in just 5 days. But Super Mario Bros. Is also part of a trend of video games being turned into films. We've had examples like Tomb Raider 1 and 2, and there's a forthcoming Tetris the Movie. Like television programmes once did, video games are moving from the small screen to the big. Keza McDonald is the video games editor at The Guardian and told us what she thought of the new Super Mario film.
A lot of the reviews seemed disappointed that it was essentially a children's film. You know, it's a kid's movie, but it was always going to be a kid's movie. Like, to be honest, Mario has always been a childhood thing, really. And I still think there is some snobbery from Hollywood, particularly about video games. Everyone seems to have figured out that video games make a lot of money now, which is true. Video games have been making more money than TV and film combined for over a decade now. But that's the least interesting thing about games, if you ask me. Like, for me, it's about their cultural impact. It's about the way that people are engaging with them, the way that games are becoming part of our cultural fabric. And I think that some Hollywood studios and maybe some film critics haven't quite caught up with that role that video games are playing in people's lives. I know it came as a surprise to a lot of people that HBO's adaptation of The Last of Us had a really good story.
You haven't seen the world, so you don't know.
But video games have had amazing stories for years now. It's just not quite percolated yet through some echelons of Hollywood, I think. Video game stories have really come on an awfully long way in the last 10 to 15 years, engaging with quite interesting human topics. Really, in the 80s and 90s, video game stories were very often just set dressing, right? They were an excuse for the action. The original Mario movie from the 1990s is stunningly, fascinatingly bad. If you are curious about that movie, having watched the most recent one, don't bother, honestly. It's just not worth it. Game adaptations seem to be cursed, but it's really nice to see that lifting now.
Keza McDonald. Now, I'm sure you know which band I'm referring to when I say there was Benny, there was Björn, there was Agnetha, and Anna Frid. Yes, it was ABBA. These four became one of the most successful pop bands of all time. But those in the know will tell you there was really a fifth member of ABBA. He may not have strutted his stuff front of stage, but Lasse Welander played lead guitar on most ABBA songs and so had a huge influence on their musical direction. Well, Lasse Welander has just died from cancer at the age of 70. Sancha Berg looks back now at his career.
Knowing Me, Knowing You was one of Lasse Welander's favourite ABBA songs. He'd recorded it with the band in 1976, 2 years after he'd started playing with them. The guitarist appeared on many of ABBA's most popular hits, from Thank You for the Music to The Winner Takes It All.
The winner takes it all, the loser standing small.
He played on the soundtracks for the Mamma Mia films and ABBA's 2021 comeback album Voyage. Lasse Welander was more than a backing player. He added guitar lines, brought his own sounds to recordings. In a statement, the ABBA band members paid tribute to Lasse Welander's skills and creativity. The group said his death, age 70, was premature, and they would remember what they called the musical brilliance of the man who'd played such an integral role in the ABBA story.
Sancha Berg. Now, what do you think is the biggest threat to the world's water supply? Population growth is a potential problem. Climate change certainly, as global heating evaporates away the sources we rely on. But a new study warns there's more danger from the unequal use of the water we have. The research was published in the leading science journal Nature and says social inequality and the mismanagement of water systems represents a compelling and serious challenge, one which must be addressed. Charlie Jones reports.
5 years ago, Cape Town in South Africa nearly ran out of water. Day zero, as it was known, would have meant the taps running dry for millions of people. That's one example of the type of water crisis researchers say could be coming to many, if not most, cities around the world, estimating that more than 1 billion people will face a water shortage in the near future. The paper says one of the main causes of these droughts is that the rich are taking far more than their fair share. The researchers say that in Cape Town, wealthier people use 10 to 50 times the amount of water the poorest do. They say they've found similar issues in London and warn the inequality is unsustainable. They also criticise governments around the world for not directly addressing the issue. In the UK, ministers say that 4 billion extra litres of water will be needed every day by 2050. They plan for half of that to come from extra supply and the rest by fixing leaks and reducing demand. But the government hasn't said if it will specifically target those who use the most.
Charlie Jones. Now, the American rapper Kanye West is back in headlines, this time because a school he founded in California, Donda Academy, is being sued by two of its former teachers. Paige Skinner is a reporter for BuzzFeed who's been covering the story. She's been speaking to my colleague James Reynolds and started by telling him a little more about the school.
It's a private Christian school that Kanye West opened last year, and it's located in California, and it teaches grades kindergarten through 12th grade. And it's named after his mother, Donda, who died about 15 years ago. And it's unaccredited. That's important to know.
And I wonder if that's playing into the next part of what you and I are talking about, the fact that two former teachers are suing the school. Take us through what the lawsuit's about.
Yeah, two former teachers are suing Kanye West and Donda Academy because they said that they complained about how the school was run and then they were fired without explanation. So the lawsuit kind of gets into some of the unusual rules that Kanye West had in place at Donda Academy. For instance, teachers weren't allowed to hang artwork in their classrooms, and students were only allowed to eat sushi for lunch, which is very odd. There were allegedly no tables or chairs, so the students had to sit on the ground. Also, the students had to wear black head-to-toe in clothes that Kanye West designed. Nobody could wear jewelry, Nike or Adidas. And maybe one of the weirdest ones I thought was that there were no classes upstairs because Kanye West is allegedly scared of stairs. So, yeah, the lawsuit just goes into kind of how weird this school was and how the teachers didn't think it was up to standard.
Paige, we'll come to Kanye West's reaction in a moment. Firstly, I suppose a question on everyone's mind, what happens if a kid doesn't like sushi?
Yeah, I'm not sure, because they aren't allowed to bring any outside food or drink to school. So I guess you're just going to have to wait till after school and eat some macaroni and cheese at home.
Yeah. And obviously important in this story that we get any on the record response that has been either from the Donda Academy or from Kanye West.
Nope, we haven't heard from Kanye West or his lawyers or Donda Academy, which is kind of unusual for Kanye West because he seems to respond to almost everything.
How much of a talking point is this at BuzzFeed and among the people you speak to, the Donda Academy and the teachers' lawsuit?
Yeah, it seems to be a pretty big deal. I mean, Kanye West is a pretty fascinating guy. He's one of the world's most famous rappers, and he's also a fashion designer. But when he decided last year to open up this school and go into the direction of education, it kind of made everybody raise their eyebrows. And then no one really knew what was happening inside of the school. So this lawsuit is the first kind of glimpse into it. And the rules are just the alleged rules are just kind of insane. So I think it just kind of adds to this idea that maybe Kanye's just living in his own world.
Paige Skinner. And that's it from all of us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Alana Bowles and the producer was Olivier Oteba. The editor is Karen Martin, and I'm Paul Moss. Until next time, goodbye.